Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Peel Your Phantom Podcast. My name is Sate.
And I am Jim.
You are Jim. What's shaking, baby?
Pretty much just my bootay, as per usual, but I mean, you know. It's good. Things are good. My band has our first show back from our holiday break tomorrow,
and I'm looking forward to that.
We haven't played since before Christmas, and that's largely because it gets pretty fucking cold up here in this neck of the woods. But that's ostensibly the excuse we're using. The real reason is because I had to have my tonsils out, and we weren't sure about my recoup time. But I'm actually feeling really strong.
They look like big, good, strong hands, don't they?
I actually feel like, based on the lack of extra tissue in my throat, I actually added some to my range on both ends. My control is better. My pitch feels more solid. My vibrato is more consistent. I feel pretty good about things. So I'm looking forward to that. How you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. It's now the weekend. We're recording Friday as we talk, and I think today is St. Patrick's Day as we record this, yeah?
Yeah, today is St. Patrick's Day.
So even without thinking about it, I'm wearing a green shirt. Now it's a Green Lantern shirt because I'm still a huge-ass nerd, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it totally counts.
Counts, right. But, I'm good. I've been playing a lot of Metroid these days. I picked up that they did a remaster of Metroid Prime for the Switch now from the original GameCube version, and the first one. It's not like a compendium or collection of them or anything, but it is absolutely gorgeous, stunning, and fantastic to play. And they changed the controller scheme so you could play it like on a modern controller and not feel too funky, because the GameCube controller, while beloved, was also a very big kind of a, you had to get real used to it. Nintendo had a real habit of making weird controllers.
They really did. If you look back on it, Nintendo just really seems to want to reinvent the wheel with every controller they have. I mean, the controllers across PlayStation and Xbox are so consistent that you can actually still use Xbox One controllers, and I think even Xbox 360 controllers on an Xbox Series X, and the same with the PlayStation DualShock and all that. But if you line up all the Nintendo controllers, I mean, it's just they went off the rails there for a couple of years, and still kind of are. I mean,
It's like we talk about, they're trying to innovate. They find new ways to think outside of the box and innovate, and more power to them. That's how we get cool things like motion control and Switch and all that. But
Nintendo decided to drop out of the to drop out of the raw graphical power competition sometime around the Wii. And so then they just focused on experiences, and they've really kind of carved out a niche for that, and they've done really well with it. And admittedly, the Switch is my least played console, just because it, I don't know, man, I keep on thinking about this. I remember back in the day, which in this case was a Monday.
I hate Mondays. Hate them. Therefore, I decree from this day forward, there will be no more Mondays.
When Nintendo used to have like their seal of approval, like that gold seal on the outside of every box out of cartridge you could buy at the store, because they had their sort of strict quality control. And it just seems like every time I go on the Switch store to look and see if there's anything new, it's a whole lot of side-scrolling pixel art, a whole lot of stuff aimed at kids like Roblox and Splatoon, and it's just not for me. I mean, I really tend to gravitate towards like the really big open world, deep experiences. I just, a year later, finished Horizon Forbidden West. Fantastic game. Looking forward to the DLC next month. But the Switch, apart from like Super Mario Odyssey and Breath of the Wild and some remasters of some older games that I really liked, like Oddworld Stranger's Wrath, that kind of thing, it's just there don't seem to be a whole lot of games for me on that platform. But I am looking forward to the new Zelda game that I will definitely pick up. But
absolutely,
you know, the Metroid stuff always appealed to me too, so maybe that's something else I'll check out and get a little more mileage out of that particular piece of kit that's hooked up to my TV.
Yeah, it's really cool. Metroid Dread came out like about a year ago, and it was a lot of fun. I added some new twists on the genre, and I've been a huge Metroid fan since day one, basically. It is ridiculously one of the more complicated games in the system. It's a lot of tread and retread and retread and retread. You have to just keep...
Yeah, there's a reason why Metroidvania is considered a genre.
Yeah, between... I mean, I was never big into the Vania. I played Castlevanias and whatnot, but...
Yeah.
But Metroid I've always been about. And then they dropped this on a Nintendo Direct. They're like, oh, by the way, Metroid Prime Remaster on the eShop right now. Go pick it up. And then they're like, oh, we're going to do a physical release 2 weeks from now. So I'm like, I'm not going to pick it up on the eShop. I'll pick up I like having the physical for these things as much as possible. And so I'm like, oh, it's going to be a big release. No problem, right? It sold out. Pretty much everywhere.
Fucking figures.
Instantly. Like, they were still popping up sporadically around the area, but nowhere near where I was. And so I just resigned myself to be like, all right, well, I'm either going to have to buy... Because they were automatically going on the secondary market for, like, double the price. And as we already talked scalpers. About with the PS5, I'm not paying scalper prices.
Oh, hell no!
I'd rather wait.
No.
And so I was getting to the point where I'm like, oh, I might have to buy this on the eShop and just wait. But... I finally managed to track down. Basically, what happened is GameStop got theirs in late. And so there was a GameStop at the mall about a little over a week after street date that they still hadn't gotten them. And so I was calling them every day. And finally, they got theirs in and they're like, yeah, we have one copy left. I'm like, I'll be there in 15 minutes. So the me wanting to wait didn't happen. But. I'll tell you what, it's a fantastic game. And then not even like a week after I picked up Metroid Remaster, or Metroid Prime Remaster, I picked up on the Nintendo Online bundle that they've got, where you could play like NES games and you could play Super Nintendo games. Now you could play some Nintendo 64 games. They also released now Game Boy games. You could play a certain amount of Game Boy games and Game Boy Advance games, and they dropped Metroid Fusion as well. Which is one of the best, if not the best, games on the Game Boy Advance. And so I.
Well, you are giving me all kinds of reasons to fire that thing up. I really did, yeah. Well, kind of the thing that I'm waiting for, and I think I've mentioned this before, is I'm not usually into turn-based strategy games, but one of the best games for me, I don't know why it spoke to me so much, but I really enjoyed it, was Advance Wars and Advance Wars 2 on the Game Boy Advance. I loved those things.
Well, that remaster's coming out.
It was kind of tile-based. It is, in theory. It was supposed to be out Christmas before last. And they just keep on delaying it because, you know, the reason why they said it was because, and I know we've talked about this before, that the Russia-Ukraine war. Because one of the opposing generals in this sort of war simulation is named Olaf, and he wears a kind of quasi-Russian uniform. And so they don't want to play into that too much. And I get that. I understand that it might be insensitive to release a war game, but there's never not conflict in the world. And the game is kind of cartoony, it's kind of goofy, it's tile-based, top-down, isometric, turn-based strategy, and I really liked it. And I actually, it's the entire reason why I bought one of those sort of like slightly bootleggy retro consoles that come from overseas that got, you know, 110,000 games on them, because it was like $100, and I bought it mostly to play Advance Wars on the TV, because I have, you know, like you do, the Ambernic handheld, but it's just a little small. Even though it came out originally in the Game Boy Advance platform, it's still just a little bit small for my old-ass eyes, and I like to be able to play it on the old 65-inch 4K TV. Yeah, the remaster has updated graphics. It's the same game, but it's a little bit prettier looking. And I'm really looking forward to that if and when it drops. But other than that, I don't know, man. I haven't turned on my Switch in a while, but I really need to.
Well, the release date's been set for April 21st on Advance Wars 1 and 2.
Awesome.
Reboot camp.
Well, maybe they'll finally kick it out now. Well, maybe they'll finally get it out.
That's according to Nintendo of America on a tweet that was released on February 8th. So it's
April's going to be kind of a big month then, because yeah. the Horizon Forbidden West, I actually spent a little bit of time, I just really did finish this game maybe 2 or 3 days ago, put some time into it. Before I finished it, though, I really, because I knew there was DLC coming out, I did a whole lot of resource grinding to level up these legendary weapons, because from what I understand... the Burning Shores DLC is coming out, I want to say the 19th of April.
Okay.
And it is coming out exclusively on PS5. Now, as we all know, because of the delays in the sort of, whether you want to call it next generation or current generation hardware, the Xbox Series X and the PS5, Because there were such bad supply chain issues for a while, and it took people a long time to get their hands on those consoles, a lot of developers, if they wanted to even sell any games at all, were sort of hamstrung, and they had to develop games for both the current generation and what was considered then next generation consoles. So
right.
PS4 and PS5, Xbox One and Xbox Series X, and it kind of... They did it with varying degrees of success. I mean, obviously there was the whole Cyberpunk thing, which was kind of a mess. It was unplayable on current-gen consoles. But because people actually have a much larger installed user base now with these current-generation consoles, the Guerrilla Games, the developer of the Horizon series, has come out with this DLC, and it's strictly PS5. So they're kind of leaving the PS4 players in the dust a little bit, but... They said the reason they did that is because there's a lot of things that they could do on the PS5 that they couldn't do while developing for parallel platforms. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it.
Apparently
the graphics are sharper, the lighting is better, and they've alluded to one particular giant battle scene that would not have been possible on PS4 hardware. So that should be fun. So I spent a little bit of time grinding up all my legendary weapons in preparation for that. It did make the end game a lot easier than it would have otherwise, but I feel like my particular Aloy in my game is pretty well tricked out, as well as she can be, to be able to handle whatever the power of the PS5 DLC can throw at her.
I need to pick up one of those games. I haven't played any of the Horizon games, so...
They're fucking fantastic. I mean, and the stories. It's a great game. It's beautiful. It plays well. It's a very... I guess they call them the Ubisoft-style open-world game, where it's just a huge map littered with icons and side quests and things to go and do.
Which, as we know and talk about, is your kind of your genre. That's your thing. Don't play with me right now. This is
my jam. It really is. It's my favorite thing. I mean, a lot of people criticize that as like, oh boy, opening up this game and seeing this. And I love that shit. I love the fetch quest. I love the side quest. I love the collectibles. I love all that shit. And Horizon in particular has a really, really good story it's based on a post-apocalyptic world, which all the games seem to be now. But humanity, after the collapse, has kind of descended into tribalism. And it's a weird mix of, like, somewhat futuristic technology mixed with, like, you know, caveman-style weaponry. But there are robot animals and dinosaurs, and they call them machines, that you kind of... They're the primary enemies in the game. But you kind of have to figure out what they're doing there and how they were created and what the deal is with it. And the story is really deep, incredibly wide-ranging, and it unfolds over a couple of different games. And it can get a little sticky and weird and convoluted at times, but... It really does make sense when you kind of step back and look at the larger picture. I really enjoy the games for the gameplay. They look gorgeous. The story is great. It dovetails perfectly with the kind of game that I like to play. And next time you have, you know, 6 or 8 months free, play those two back to back, because they do take... Not that I'm saying everybody has to play these games like I do, where you do every side quest, you turn over every stone, you open every chest. You can finish the game in about 30 hours. I've got about 110 in my playthrough of Forbidden West, so... That should go to tell you just how granular I get with my gameplay with these things. But they really are good if you have the time to invest in them.
Yeah, I'm probably going to look into that. We'll see what happens. But let's see. Other than that, I mean, I don't have a whole lot in the news folder today. And that could possibly be because as we sit and record this, we just recorded 2 days ago for the previous week's episode. We talked about some Ninja Turtle action. And we're actually trying to get ahead a couple episodes before we jaunt off to sunny Las Vegas. So. It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. Oh, good. We'll get some more use out of that Tom Jones sound clip I created.
But well, I mean, you know, we could. That's just what I think of. I always think of that as kind of like being the quintessential lounge song. I mean, there's, you know, Viva Las Vegas or Leaving Las Vegas. There's all kinds of Las Vegas-themed songs. It tends to evoke strong emotions in people. It certainly does me. But just always think of Tom Jones first. He, to me, is like the quintessential lounge singer with the swinging Burt Bacharach horns and the panties and room keys flying on stage. It's just kind of, that's how it goes.
It was either Tom Jones or... Burt Bacharach, Frank Sinatra, what else we got there?
Wayne Newton.
Wayne Newton, that's the one I was trying to think of. Wayne Newton, I was trying to
Bobby Darin.
Why do I think Neil Diamond for some reason? Did he have anything to do with Vegas?
Yeah, he's definitely got that sort of like loungy, open V-shirt, chest hair, swinging kind of vibe going. Yeah, it's just, I think of Neil Diamond when I think of Vegas, for sure.
If I did the open V, man, I got too many. My tits are too big. It'd be too gross for most people.
Ugh. If they can't handle it, then that's on them.
But looking forward to Vegas. That's awesome. I haven't had a vacation in fucking forever. So, I mean, this will be neat. Even though it's brief, it'll be really neat. I did get a chance to go to the signing. My buddy Eric had a comic book signing at Gabby's Cards and Comics in town. Yeah, but yeah, he released a comic book. It's not prestige format, but it's like magazine format. It's bigger than a normal comic book. It's like a magazine size. It is rated M for mature. And it is also...
Well, then like why are you holding it?
65 pages deep. And so I went and got that signed. So it's created by my buddy Eric and his co-writer Greg Rucka, who you may have heard of. Rucka does a lot of work. He's very, very busy. It was nice to meet him. And then the art's done by Mike Henderson. This is absolutely beautiful. I have yet to sit down and read it because I've been editing like a fiend for the last couple of days. But I'm really intrigued by it. And Eric signed it with Enjoy the Gorilla Joke. So now I'm really curious as to what the hell that means. So we'll find out. But I'm looking forward to reading that. And in fact, Eric might be coming on the show somewhat soon to talk about it. So
woohoo! Looking forward to that.
Put a bug in that. Put a pin in that. And we got some more episodes coming up now. Of course, we've got the episode coming up where we talk about voice actors, because you said it, now it has to happen. So that's on the agenda. We got some more guests coming up that I'm super excited about. One that we should be recording here rather quickly, as we record today. So just a lot of good fun things on the horizon. We got some returning guests that we need to get booked and scheduled. We had to wait for the busy ass month of March to kind of dwindle down and
busy.
But got all sorts of fun shit planned for the Future Random Podcast. So before we
cut
to the topic, I wanted to kind of send a shout out to you, our listeners. I kind of want to know something about you. Now, normally we ask you what your opinion is on the topic that we talk about. We solicit your opinions and we solicit your emails and your text messages and whatnot. But today I kind of wanted to know, we'll talk to you about that for sure. But for today I kind of wanted to know, most nerds have a desk in their home, some place to sit and do their nerdery. I have a desk that I sit at to do the podcast. I know Jim does as well. And of course, we're both surrounded by our various nerdery. But I kind of wanted to know what you guys have that represents your fandoms, your nerdery, your geekery. What do you have on your desks that kind of symbolize and hold value and meaning to you? On my desk, of course, we've talked about it a number of times. I've got this three-segmented desk riser, just because I had so much stuff on my desk that I needed to, like, under space to put other stuff. And because I do a lot of, like, handheld video game repair, Game Boy repair and DS repair and things like that. And so I have my tools for that, and I have the rubber mat, the silicon mat that I use for that, and the soldering iron and everything like that. And I have those tucked underneath this riser. But on top of the riser, on the right segment, I have three 3DSs, Nintendo 3DSs. They're three of my favorite designs. I looked them out the other day because I was pulling them out to mod another one of my 2DSs. I sold one of my 2DS, or my 3DS, my daily driver, to my buddy Daryl. Shout out, Daryl. What's up, man?
Hello!
But I needed another one to carry with me to work. And so I modded a 2DS that I got, a purple and silver 2DS. I love that thing. But so on my desk, I have three of the maybe 15 2DS/3DS platform that I have. I have a lot of that platform. But my Hyrule Edition 3DS that I got from Japan... I've got my Super Nintendo 3DS that I got from my buddy Rob. And I've got my Galaxy 3DS, which is still one of the more beautiful ones that they've ever released.
That was a gorgeous unit.
And then I've got, and these are all on stands, because of course they are. They need to be displayed. I've got a Game & Watch, one of the first dual-screen Game & Watches, the Donkey Kong Game & Watch, that was bought for me as a present from my buddy Eric, who's been on the show before. We talked about Cobra Kai, but I officiated his wedding, and that was my my little gift token of affection from them.
Hello.
So that has a place of honor on my desk. In addition, on that platform, I have six different Game Boy Micros, because as we've discussed, Game Boy Micro is absolutely one of my favorite handhelds ever, and so that's where those live. Middle segment, I've got an odd assortment of things. It's the two newest replicate cabinets from New Wave Toys. I can only display two on my desk at a time, so I usually just go with the latest and greatest. And so I've got Food Fight right now and Missile Command. And in front of those, I've got the little stools that they released, that kind of the scale models of the stools that people sit on in front of an arcade cabinet.
Tiny little stool sample.
But they're great because they're actually made of really heavy-duty stuff. They're plushy, and they're squishy, and they're just like a regular stool should be, with little rubber feet, so you don't scratch your floor or your desk. But, yeah, little plushy stools. And then in front of that, because of no particular reason, I have a model kit of a ramen cup noodle.
Okay, but why, though?
That I put together. It was a Bandai model kit that I got off of Sendico from Japan, and it's... You can kind of hear it. That's the little shrimps in the top of the cup noodle.
And the make me hungry, man. That's some hardcore nerd chow right there.
The little beef. But it's just like, if you walk into my house, this thing is so detailed that it just looks like I left a cup noodle sitting on my desk, which is kind of funny. And then the last segment on my desk, I have a couple of things. I've got my Gene Roddenberry commemorative coins that I like to have sitting there. Kind of like challenge coins. Sitting next to that, I've got my Harvey Dent Two-Face coin, which I've not used to make any major decisions in my life. I should probably rectify that. And then I've got my three boom boxes that I also got from New Wave Toys. Shout out to Shia Oprychek. Those things are beautiful. They work amazing.
I'm sorry if you can't understand, but I need a radio inside my hand.
And then, of course, my gnome who flips the bird. The double bird.
The double deuce.
He sits there on my desk, reminding me to keep it humble. So, but that's the nerd shit on my desk. Jim, what do you got on your desk that's nerd related? Or around
your deskial area? Yeah, not my actual desk, but I definitely keep my Ambernic handheld multi-platform handheld console. It's got the form factor of a Game Boy Advance, but it's one of those overseas kind of bootleggy consoles. It's got a whole bunch of different games, retro games on it.
Yeah.
Most of my nerd stuff is over to the side. I've got... I don't really collect lunchboxes, but if I find a lunchbox that's something interesting, I will go ahead and grab onto it. I've got my Fallout lunchbox that came when I bought the Pip-Boy edition of Fallout 4. That also came with a Pip-Boy. You could actually put a smartphone in and use as a Pip-Boy that would interact with the game. That was pretty cool. Did that a couple of times.
I remember that. I wanted to get that.
Yeah. It was a little clunkier than what was practical, but it was a fun thing that they did. And, of course, the Pip-Boy bobblehead, the Vault Boy bobblehead that came with that. And that's on the lunchbox. I got a couple of bobbleheads of Jay and Silent Bob, some signed action figures I picked up when they did the movies pop up here in my town. I've got a big, like, 18-inch tall Iron Giant, because I've always loved the Iron Giant. If you've never seen the Iron Giant animated film, it's both
shame
a
on
brilliant...
you!
Shame. Shame. Shame.
Shame on you!
Yeah, it's a brilliant Cold War story about a boy and his giant robot, but it's also, I identify with that character a lot as being like, hey, he's kind of big and scary, but he's got a gentle heart, and you can choose... to be whoever you are on the inside based on, you know, what you want, regardless of how people treat you on the outside. And that's a good thing to remember. I've got a Voltron that I've had for years that
I
leave it assembled. Yeah, but you can break it down into its individual lines if you want. I leave it assembled and standing kind of on the desk. And as we mentioned in the Junko Pop episode, I've got a bunch of Funkos. And they're all Queen related. I've got the Freddie Mercury, John Deacon, Roger Taylor, and Brian May Funkos. I got two sets of those because one comes with the Live Aid Freddie Mercury with the tank top and the studded armband and blue jeans. Yeah. And then there's the other Freddy with the 70s Freddy with the Harlequin jumpsuit. And then the other Funko, because that's eight. It's a four-person band. And then they also came out with a Funko of the robot from the cover of News of the World, which is one of my favorite Queen albums.
It's a good album.
Yeah, it really is. So I've got that as well. But then it's just kind of like a lot of books. You know, some comic books over there that I'm trying to get to. Some different novels, just like all the things, the to-read pile is over there. But yeah, I've definitely got some stuff over there. I really wish I could find. I have a box somewhere. It's in storage. It's in a storage unit. I never really collected a whole lot of toys, but I do collect, like, token toys from certain lines that represent things. So I have a Mask, which was, you know, the mid-80s cartoon series of... vehicles that transformed into other vehicles, not Transformers,
fucking
not GoBots,
love Mask.
But Mask. I've got Firefly from the Mask series. I've got a He-Man and a Skeletor. A full range of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, along with a Splinter and a Casey Jones and an April O'Neil. I've got an Optimus Prime. So I've got, and they're all somewhere. I don't know where they are. The last time I saw them was when I lived in Vegas a couple years ago. So they're around. I just have to dig them up. I've got them somewhere. And I'm working on getting a kind of entertainment center style cabinet. And I think I've picked one out at IKEA that is the exact dimensions of my television. It's got some storage, shelving and cabinets that I could use to put game consoles in, store some media, and there's a nice big wide shelf on top that I'm trying to break out and display all of my miniature arcade cabinets. So I'm just trying to make some more room to kind of get some more things out, but in so doing, I really need to go and look for a lot of my old toys that I had just as kind of representative examples to say, hey, I don't really collect the full line of Turtles, but I have all the Turtles. I don't really collect all of the Transformers anymore or all the He-Man, but I've got a couple of each just to kind of represent this is a thing that I really liked when I was a kid and I was super into. And just kind of like, you know, like I said, token representatives of these different fandoms, these different toy lines that I could put out if I can dig them up. But I just got to kind of spelunk through some of my storage areas around here and crack open some boxes and see what I might have done with those things. But mostly it's just a couple of Funkos, a couple of books, a couple of action figures, some lunch boxes, just little stuff like that. But just little things to kind of remind me of kind of where my fandoms are, where they come from, what I'm into. You know, once you get to be an adult and you actually have some adult money, you can kind of buy all the toys that you had as a kid and just kind of, you know, have them around. Just to remind you of where you came from. I think that's important.
But if you look at it, I sent you the picture. If you look at the picture, you can see Voltron and Devastator on the bottom shelf, and they're just fucking humongous.
Oh, yeah.
And the Megatron's the Masterpiece Megatron. Masterpiece Prime, you can't barely see him, but he's behind Megatron there. Hot Rod, Masterpiece Hot Rod. And then shelf up, you can see some of the smaller Transformers that I have, which are more like small slash regular size. Shelf up from that, you can see my Lego Prime.
Yep.
And then my smaller systems, like the Nintendo Classic and Super Nintendo Classic. And then my few Funkos that I have on that top shelf. I guess I have seven. I thought I had six. I have seven. I've got the D.O. Droid from Star Wars. I've got the Funko of me. I got John Wick and his dog. I got Hannibal Lecter with the blood as the chase figure. And then I got, open, without the boxes, I have Grogu and the This Is Fine Dog, the Sitting in Fire, This Is Fine Dog. And then Tupac, Tiny Tupac keeps me company, so.
Ain't nothing but against the party.
Cute.
But yeah, I mean, that's what keeps us happy. We surround ourselves with our assorted nerdery, and we're going to post these pictures up on Instagram. So you can see kind of our areas, but we want to know, we want to see your areas. We want you to send us a picture of your nerd spaces, because that makes me unbelievably happy, is seeing the stuff that makes people really stoked and happy, seeing their representatives. Yeah, that's exactly why we do this. So send us that information, if you please. You can find us in a number of different ways. Hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/fuelyourfandom. You can hit us up with a good old-fashioned email at fuelyourfandom@gmail.com.
And the good old-fashioned backup email is fyftalentbooking@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at fuelyourfandom, on what's left of Twitter at fuel_your. And, of course, you can find us where all fine podcasts are bought, traded, stolen, and bartered at Audible and Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts and iHeartRadio and Stitcher and all of the And I've been neglecting to mention this, but you also can find us on our website at fuelyourfandom.buzzsprout.com. And my boy Saint is always super on top of getting the latest and greatest episode uploaded every Friday morning. Yeah. And if you're impatient and can't wait for it to get syndicated, you can always find us and listen to us there. And honestly, as always, however you find us, however you hear us, however you make us a part of your day, we are endlessly flattered and grateful that you do.
Absolutely we are. And show us what you got. Like they said in Rick and Morty, show us what you got.
Show me what you got. I want to see what you got.
We want to see what makes you as happy as surrounding myself with my nerdery makes me happy. So,
facts.
Not what we're here to talk about today. I just thought that would be kind of interesting. I want to see your nerd environment or whatever, however you want to phrase that. What's your
geekosphere?
Yes. Hey, there you go. We use that term frequently. So, you guys are going to see behind my desk, I've got this great Fuel Your Fandom steel sign, laser-cut steel sign that was given to me by my wife for Father's Day a couple of years ago. I love it. And it serves a dual purpose now because, A, it sits behind my desk. It reminds me why I do this. And then on it, I collect these combadge pins from Star Trek. And so they come in two different varieties. They come in the pin-on version, and they come in a magnetic version. Which reminds me, I've got something to ask John next time he's on the show. But all my magnetic ones I was having trouble displaying until I got this sign. And now they just totally right on the bottom of this Fuel Your Fandom sign that I've got. It's great. And I've got a shadow box with more pins. And then, of course,
good
counteracting
times.
All the Star Trek, I've got a rack of six lightsabers beside the desk as well. So what are you going to do? You can like anything you want. You can like Star Trek and Star Wars. Nobody's telling you you can't. If they are telling you you can't, fuck them. You don't need that negativity in your life. I'm like, fuck you and fuck her too. Do what you want. Make yourself happy. Lord knows we could all use a little bit of happy these days.
Life is too goddamn short to stay miserable. So
that's a fact.
Do your thing.
Speaking of happy, let's go go the complete opposite route, because today we're not talking about happy. We're talking about nerdy, but we're going to talk about... Jim and I were talking back and forth a while back, and we were talking about specifically children's movies that have content that can be construed as traumatic for children. And we started going down this list of movies, and this list just started popping and popping and popping and popping and popping. And so I decided to make that a topic, and I wanted to find out from you guys. And I put a poll on the Facebook page. I got some answers for it. I started quizzing everybody I was driving around for work as far as what childhood movies scarred them as a child. And so we got a lot of really great answers and stuff to talk about. I do have to make an aside, though. A lot of people misconstrued the question when I asked this, and they kind of took it to mean, what movie did you see as a child that screwed you up? And that's a completely other thing. That's either a...
Yeah.
Your parents were just...
It's a separate conversation.
But that wasn't the question, but that was certainly an interesting outcome. It's like, whether it's because you snuck out and watched a movie like you shouldn't have been watching, like Faces of Death or whatever the hell else, and...
Or whether something popped on cable and you were unsupervised, that's a thing too. But yeah, we're specifically asking about what children's movies had content that was probably questionable for putting things into a children's movie. And there's plenty of that, and we'll get to that in a second. But nonetheless, we appreciate your responses, and we're going to get to all that in just a moment.
I found some really interesting answers there, people. You guys have been watching some effed up stuff while you were young enough not to watch that. The only real, the only one I can remember that I watched super, super young that kind of screwed with me as a kid was I was like 12 or 13, and I had ended up watching, like, my parents put on A Clockwork Orange.
This would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of the old ultra-violence.
Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, which, if you haven't seen it...
Oh, boy.
Holy crap. It is...
I mean, yeah. It's one of my favorite movies, but it's not one of my favorite movies because it's enjoyable to watch.
It's well made.
I have to make that distinction.
It's well made. It's a masterpiece of filmmaking. I love Malcolm McDowell.
And the story is fantastic. The subject matter of it is really important and very thought-provoking and really provokes a lot of discussion. But it's not a pleasant film to watch. It's really full of some pretty adult subject matter. And I'm not saying adult subject matter in terms of, like, adult relationships. I'm talking about violence, and specifically sexual violence, and just horrifying things that are not pleasant to watch. But within the context of how it's presented... You know, I mean, there's a debate that's raged for generations. It was banned in the UK for a while because of this, of whether or not it was necessary to depict the violence as graphically as it is. But given how everything came together with the story and the themes of how it handles those things, I think it's an important film to watch. But it can be very disturbing for some people.
Important
and certainly disturbing for somebody
Jesus.
Who's... I watched it for the first time in college, and I'm still fucked up about it. But at least it was well past the point where... I was at least considered, you know, by society as being somebody who could handle that kind of stuff. But it's very thought-provoking and very, very interesting. But, it's not a movie that you want to watch if you have any sensitivity around that kind of thing.
Yeah, it does take some context, which I did not have as a 12 or 13-year-old. So.
Yeah, and for me, I actually had a babysitter, and I probably, I was younger than 10, I know that. I was grade school, so probably maybe 7 or 8 years old. And I had a babysitter who didn't know better and took us, my sister and I, to a movie as a means of kind of just like, yeah, have a seat. And, you know, I know it was my parents, but it was a babysitter who took me to see Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, still one of my favorite movies. I love Indiana Jones. Harrison Ford is one of my all-time favorite actors. But and that movie, it was just a lot of swashbuckling action. But there were some really disturbing moments in that movie. And again, this is we're talking about a movie that's about 40 years old now. So if you haven't seen it, Smoke, close your ears if you haven't seen Raiders. I know you have, but nonetheless, we're going to spoil a couple things here for you. There's the one part where Indy is fighting the giant muscle-bound airplane mechanic as the blocks from the airplane wheels outside the pyramid in Cairo are starting to spin around. And it's a propeller plane because it is the 40s. And this guy gets blindsided and chopped into gooey bits. There's kind of a discretion shot happening. You don't really see this guy get decimated by an airplane propeller, but you do see Indy get sprayed with blood, and it's pretty clear what's happening.
You see the red mist.
That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much all that's left once this propeller gets a hold of this dude. But the scene that I think a lot of people would think of when they think about, wow, you watched Raiders when you were 10 years old, was, of course, the scene where they opened the Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nazis surrounding the Ark, having the one guy who had his entire head cave in, the other guy who had his melt right off of his skull, and the last guy who had his explode. It's a 1-2-3 knockout punch of fucking horror in an otherwise kind of like swashbuckling hero action movie.
Don't look at it. Shut your eyes, Murray, and don't look at it no matter what happens.
Kind of comes out of nowhere. And as a kid, you don't really have the ability to break apart reality and fantasy. I certainly didn't have the mental capacity to understand, like, the geopolitics that went into World War II. I just saw, hey, there's this grizzled hero with the bullwhip, the stubble, and the fedora, and he's out there kicking butt and rescuing people and artifacts. But then this thing at the end came out of nowhere. And then, of course, the ghosts flying around, which, I mean, as a practical effect, you can argue whether or not it holds up today. But at the time, I was scared shitless by that, and I had nightmares about it. But again, that's not what we're talking about today. Those are grown-up movies. Clockwork Orange and Raiders are movies that were intended for an adult audience. We're specifically talking today about movies that were conceived of, written, produced, released, and marketed to kids, mm-hmm. but that had content in them that today you look back and go, holy shit, what were they thinking?
What the fuck, bro?
Now, just before we move on to that, I want to mention a couple of the honorable mentions, we'll call them, of movies that people shouldn't watch. Oh, I just sent Jim a picture of a candle that they made for Raiders of the Lost Ark with his melting face. It's fantastic. But a couple of movies that were not kid movies that were people are exposed to that they commented on. The Mummy. Not really a kid's movie, but my friend Kayla was experiencing a little bit of fear based on Imhotep himself, which I can get. Night of the Living Dead. Linda, my friend Linda Bostic, watched Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, that would scare the shit out of me as a kid, too. Yeah.
Yep.
My friend Robert, Dr. Robert, Altered States. John Hurt turning into an Australopithecine and eating a goat alive broke four-year-old me. No, four-year-old's a little young for that, Rob.
Yeah.
My guitar player James says, me and some buddies thought we were tough at 10 and decided that The Grudge Unrated was the correct decision.
Nope.
However, we were indeed incorrect.
Yeah, that's a mistake.
Yeah. My buddy Mark, I'll mention this one because it's not really germane to the other part of the conversation, but he mentioned one specific line in Return of the Jedi, which, I mean, all kids watch Return of the Jedi, but he said there was nothing as chilling or disturbing as Palpatine's singular line,
"Oh, I'm afraid the deflector shield will be quite operational when your friends arrive. Come, boy. See for yourself."
And I get that. My former guitar player Chris said The Thing, which, that still messed me up. I'm old as fuck now, and that movie would still get me.
Yeah.
Jaws, my friend Gabe watched Jaws, my God. Daryl, aforementioned my buddy Daryl. Children of the Corn, that movie fucked. I watched that one when I was like 16. But that one still got me.
What the hell were you thinking?
I don't know, man. Like I said, my dad was super into everything Stephen King, and so, I mean, I checked it out. And then my friend Lisa.
That's a separate conversation. We did our Stephen King episode, but I started reading Stephen King really early, probably junior high, because there was a, this is a little bit of a side, I'll make it quick, but the movie rental place in my town would put up the movie posters in the windows to tell you what the upcoming attractions were and what was coming into the store for rent, and then they would take the posters down, and they would sell the posters for like a quarter or a buck or whatever, and I would go in there with my whatever change I could scrape together, and I'd buy movie posters, and my childhood bedroom was papered with movie posters that of movies that I really liked. And I had seen Stand By Me when I was a kid, because, you know, it's, you want to go see a dead body, sure, I mean, but it was kind of for kids.
It's a coming of age movie. Though it was,
yeah. Some teenagers in it, and I was about the age of like your Will Wheatons and your Jerry O'Connells and your Corey Feldmans when that movie came out. So I did watch it and I enjoyed it. And then I got the poster for that movie and I hung it up in my room. And as I'm just kind of like sitting there one day just reading all the credits on the posters, I saw based on the short story The Body by Stephen King. So I thought, Stephen King, I've heard of that guy. Maybe he's good. So I went with my trusty library card and I went down to my local library and I checked out the book that The Body was a part of. It was a short story collection. I don't remember if it was Different Seasons or if it was Night Shift or whatever it was. It's been a long time. But I read that, loved it, and then just started reading everything Stephen King did. So movies being very visceral and very visual are one thing, but I started reading horror novels when I was probably, 11 or 12 years old, and they didn't bother me as much as some of these movies did.
Yeah, there's a lot that... That shouldn't have been gone. And it was Different Seasons, by the way. I looked it up.
But, gotcha.
The last one I want to mention is my friend Lisa, who I used to work with. She remarked, Rosemary's Baby, The Birds, Race with the Devil, Crowhaven Farm.
Yeah, that would do
Rosemary's Baby, I still can't watch. That's a messed up one. But, I mean, we got some interesting responses to all of this, so... But again, that's not the main topic. We wanted to know actual children's fare. And of course, it starts young. I mean, as far back as I can remember, one of the earliest examples that I had of this was Bambi. And, Bambi's a lighthearted romp of growing up, this little baby deer growing up and meeting his friends. And you know, the movie caps or starts off with his mother getting shot by a hunter.
Bambi, quick, the thicket!
That's pretty visceral for a young child. That's a gruesome reality and an example of the fact that we're all going to die. It's mortality put on display, and you didn't really have a lot of that as a kid. Mortality.
No, it's been said more often than once. I don't remember who made the point, but some famous thinker, writer, author, philosopher, whatever, made the point that your childhood is over the moment you realize your mortality. The second you realize you're going to die someday, that's when your innocence is gone.
Right, and that's kind of what we wanted to talk about today, is just these movies that just kind of spark that lack of innocence or that loss of innocence. And I know Bambi was one of the earliest examples for me. Jim, you want to throw one out?
This came along a little bit. I wasn't an adult yet. I was still a kid, but it was one of those things that I remember being kind of squidgy and kind of freaky. And one of those things that I thought, if this is a movie for kids, they really shouldn't put that kind of thing in there. But Christopher Lloyd dipping the shoe in Roger Rabbit. Making it pretty clear that this 55-gallon drum of solvent or whatever it is the only thing that can actually kill a tune. You know, obviously that when we were kids, the tunes, you're watching cartoons, and Wile E. Coyote can blow himself up and he's burned to a crisp in one scene, and then he's bouncing back, making another Acme order slightly after that. A giant rock can fall on his head and, you know, he's fine a minute later. Part of this, the cartoon violence of just hitting yourself in the head with a hammer until a giant goose egg pops out of your skull, and then there's birds dancing around your nugget, and then it just kind of goes away by the next scene. Cartoons are ostensibly
there's no
immortal,
permanence.
So,
yeah, there's no permanence.
Yeah. So the judge, Christopher Lloyd's judge in Roger Rabbit, proving that, yes, there is a way to actually kill tunes, and he grabs this innocent, squeaky, little cute shoe, and he dips it into the dip, and the thing dissolves and goes away and dies.
What's that? Remember how we always thought there wasn't a way to kill a tune? Well, Doom found the way. Turpentine, acetone, benzene. He calls it the dip.
I'll catch the rabbit, Mr. Valiant. Then I'll try him, convict him, and execute him.
And as a kid,
horrifying.
You're like, holy shit.
Horrifying.
Because the way that it dissipates and smokes and screams when it realizes what's happening, and then it's gone. You think to yourself, you know, you grew up with these cartoons that could fall off a cliff and then brush themselves off and go, well, back to the drawing board, and now you've got this horrifying character that knows how to kill a cartoon. And because all your favorite cartoon characters are in this movie, you don't know who he's going to go after. You don't know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. You don't know. He's demonstrated that he's got no regard for animated life. So, it's terrifying as a kid to see that.
And then his old demise at the end of the movie, too, the judge, when we find out he's a tune, we get his horrible, horrible demise at the end of the movie as well.
And his bulging eyes.
And bulging eyes. Yeah. And then didn't he get dipped? I want to say he got dipped.
I believe he did.
Relatively sure he got hoisted by his
own petard.
Yep. Use the same answer.
Yeah, live by the dip, die by the dip, bro. You brought that on yourself.
But that's actually a really good one. Now, one that we had some listener input. This comes from our buddy Aaron DiArrive. Shout out, Aaron. How's it going?
Hello.
And also, this comes from one of the guys that I was transporting, one of the train crews that I was transporting. I asked the same question to them that I posted on Facebook. And I got this answer from both of them. Old Yeller. Ostensibly a kid's movie about a boy and his dog. But yeah. This dog gets rabies.
Mm-hmm.
And this dog has to get put down at the end. And spoiler alert for like a 60-year-old movie at this point.
Remember, this is a kid's movie. This was a Disney movie.
Yeah.
And the dog gets rabies, and they have to put the dog down.
Not just they. He, the kid, has to put his dog down. Holy shit. My dog died, not naturally, but we had to have her put to sleep a while back, and I'm still not over that shit. And I'm an adult. I'm a grown-ass adult.
Yeah.
The trauma of having to put your own dog down? Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's a classic movie for a reason, and it's a good movie, and it's worth watching, but there's a reason why there's whole-ass websites that are like, does the dog die at the end? Is it Marley and Me? Is it Old Yeller?
Yeah. Yeah,
because,
for sure.
You know, I mean, it's one thing to watch John Wick or Joel Miller in The Last of Us just mow down people, and because we understand intrinsically that people can be pretty awful, and a lot of these people are poised in these films and TV shows as being antagonists, and therefore they're fair game, they're cannon fodder, they're just goons and mooks you can just mow down without impunity. But animals, right. I think everybody understands that animals are inherently innocent, and animals, they don't deserve things. Animals are furry little vessels of unconditional love. So when something terrible happens to an animal, you know they didn't do anything to deserve it.
I think that's probably why I like John Wick so much. Is because I could sympathize with John Wick going on a killing spree of Bender because his fucking dog got killed. I can get that.
It was just a fucking dog.
Just a dog. Vigo, your son, took that from me. Stole that from me. Killed that for me!
Speaking of John Wick, I'm looking forward to that so much. I actually just read a review the other day from somebody, saying that John Wick isn't just the best, John Wick 4, not just the best film in the John Wick series, but one of the best action movies ever made.
You know, and that's coming out like the week before we end up in Vegas. Maybe we should go see it together.
Definitely.
There's an idea. But, so Old Yeller definitely causes a little bit of childhood trauma. Holy shit.
And speaking of rabid animals in an ostensibly otherwise kids movie.
I was going to mention Cujo before we get to whatever you're talking about. I forgot. Remember you talking about Children of the Corn and all that and like young Stephen King movies you watched before you were Abe Jeremy?
Yep.
Fucking, I ended up watching Cujo. That's a core memory I just unlocked.
These are called core memories.
Holy shit. I don't remember how old I was, but I was too young for a rabid St. Bernard. Holy shit.
Oh, boy. Especially because anybody that's ever known a St. Bernard knows they're big, goofy, lovable, floppy dogs that have no idea how big they are. And they're just, I watched Cujo when I was in college, and it still fucked me up. But what I was thinking about was a movie, and I think this may be one of the first times that the pop culture produced a film based on a children's book that was animated, and parents thought, oh, it's an animated film. It's about cute little animals. I should bring my kids to see that. And then an entire generation got fucked up by Watership Down.
I had that answer pop up a couple of times.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I don't think, I've not actually seen Watership Down. I've seen of it. I know of it. I know screen grabs and I know the basic concepts of it, but I've not seen
it's
the
It's fucking brutal.
Yeah.
It is fucking brutal.
I know it's
really
an allegory.
Is. And,
isn't it a war allegory?
It is an allegory. You've got these rabbits who have this societal hierarchy, and sometimes they get caught in snares, and there's blood, and there's rabies, and it's just really, it's not a cute kids movie about bunnies any more than like The Velveteen Rabbit is, which is another one that has been adapted in several different forms based on a kid's book that really is just, it deals with disease and loss and all kinds of things that kids probably should learn about at some point, but if a parent thinks, oh, this is a cute little movie about animated bunnies, and I'm going to play that for my kid, and then they wind up just with wide-eyed, thumb-sucking horror based on what's being played out on the screen in front of them, yeah, don't do that.
I want that to be my nickname, wide-eyed, thumb-sucking horror. That'd be great. A name I danced under
in college.
There you go. Hey. There's another one that comes up a lot, and this one has been mentioned. I mentioned this one. A couple of my friends mentioned this one. Almost everyone I asked about childhood movies mentioned this one, and that's Artax dying in the swamp of sadness in The Neverending Story.
Get to you. You have to try. You have to care. For me. You're my friend. I love you.
And for those who don't know, it's the horse. This guy, Atreyu, has a horse that he rides. It's his best friend that he's riding into the nothing to try and save Fantasia. And Artax sinks into the swamp of sadness and dies.
Yeah.
A fucking helpless ass horse.
And Artax just literally succumbs to sadness, gives up, sinks into the swamp, and dies because he's too sad. Which, again, like, as an adult, you sort of, if you've ever struggled with depression, you understand how that can feel. But as a kid, you've got this child actor who is just emoting and begging his beloved horse to just, no, fight the sadness, Artax, you have to fight this. And this horse just has this horrified look on his face as it sinks further and further and further into the swamp of sadness. And then you have Atreyu sitting on a rock holding a lead. And there's just bubbles coming up from where the horse used to be. And as a kid, you just think to yourself, holy. It's, you know, and then as an adult, you reflect on that. You understand, oh, yeah, I understand how that can happen, to be overcome by emotion and just give up. You can't.
It's an excellent visual representation. As an adult, you're able to track that shit. And we talked about that a little bit when we talked about those stupid Kidz Bop songs and then when they were adapting, like, Linkin Park's Chester Bennington and all the dark and deep emotions that Chester taps into for his lyrics, and how it really felt weird having a child chorus singing behind it.
Things aren't the way they were before. You wouldn't even recognize me anymore. Not that you knew me back then, but it all comes back to me in the end. Kept everything inside, and even though I tried, it all fell apart. What it meant to me will eventually be a memory of a time.
I tried so hard.
But it's the same kind of feeling. It's like there's a really dark imagery behind these lyrics. There's really dark emotion behind it that they're expressing in a way to express it and release it and put it out into the universe. And that's the same kind of thing with this visual representation in Neverending Story. But that doesn't change the fact that it is just mind-chillingly terrifying as a child.
You gotta fight the sadness, Artax. No, I'm not gonna fight the sadness. I'm gonna succumb to it, give up, and die.
Right? Now, that one had a little bit of a better postscript, because as far as I remember, at the end of the movie, when everything gets fixed, Artax is there with Atreyu again.
Yep.
I'm not entirely sure, but I think that's how my brain is remembering it. So, it either happened, or my brain is just patched over that swamp of sadness with a veneer of something that... No, no, it's okay. I promise. It's okay.
No, he made it back. He found his way back.
Okay, so another example, a bit more recent, from like 2009, was the Pixar movie Up. And Up is ostensibly this tale of this kid and this curmudgeonly old man going on an adventure in a flying balloon house and, you know, lighthearted fun. There's Doug the dog and Kevin the snipe, which I love that he's named after me. I love it.
Uh-oh. No. Kevin, it's okay. Mr. Frederickson is nice.
Kevin?
Yeah, that's his name I just gave him.
But the movie starts out with a gut punch as we realize why. What is the old man's name in that movie? I forget. I want to say Walter.
Carl?
Carl. Yeah, it's because all old people seem like a Walter to me. I don't know why.
I'm just pissed. I don't want to go home.
Carl, in this movie, and his wife, Ellie, it shows how they meet, how they get together. They're both adventurous. They both like to go on these adventures and like, Indiana Jones style, you know, looking for trouble and looking for fun.
And they're saving up money in a jar to go to foreign countries and have amazing adventures as a couple.
And you see them get married. But then you see the inevitable heartbreak as they can't have a kid. I don't want to say they showed like the aftermath of a miscarriage, but I think they did. And in addition to that, Carl loses Ellie. Ellie dies. And it changes Carl intrinsically. It makes him this shut-in, this curmudgeon, this guy who doesn't want to do or anything.
Just an old man who's kind of sitting around mad at the world waiting to die.
And finally he gets it in his head that he does the balloon thing with his house to kind of leave it all behind and ends up taking Russell with him and off on an adventure they go. But that, just a gut punch at the beginning of this movie, this loss. Carl's loss of Ellie is just huge.
And it's an animated film. It's ostensibly, again, a kid's movie. And it's just, wow. The fact that they put that in there, it's just... but again, I mean, there's all kinds of kids' movies that didn't pull any punches. One of the other things that was mentioned, that we heard about, that we talked about, that still fucks a lot of people up to this day, Littlefoot's mom.
Oh! This is what I got from Daniela. My wife actually mentioned this one.
Yeah.
And I... And I made a sad face, and I said, "Mama, eat the tree star, Mama." And she's like moping the face at me and getting sad, and I'm like, "See, it still gets you."
Dear sweet little foot, do you remember the way to the Great Valley?
I guess so. But why do I have to know? You're gonna be with me.
I'll be with you, even if you can't see me.
All these years, and I mean, they ended up making, what, like 50,000 Land Before Time movies, almost all direct-to-video and whatnot, but I was the proper age for that movie when it was released, because I remember getting, like, the Pizza Hut pizza that came with those little rubber hand puppets. Do you remember those?
I do, yeah.
The little foot, and you had, like, Littlefoot and Petrie and Spike and Sarah the Bitch.
Yep, yep, yep.
Sarah was a real bitch. But it was really a kid's movie. And yeah, you get to deal with the loss of Littlefoot's mom right at the beginning that kind of starts him on his journey.
It's the Bambi thing again. I mean, when you're a kid, your parents are your whole world. I mean, they raise you. They you know, that's where you get your housing and your clothing and your food and your love and your affection and your support and everything. Your parents are your whole world. And so what's more horrifying for a kid than losing a parent? And you're just on your own. I mean, so much of these, whether it's a series of unfortunate events or whether it's Harry Potter or just the idea of the orphan, the tragic orphan, just being left to fend for themselves in a cruel world that took their parents and then continued to just throw shit in their direction. It's a recurring theme in a lot of these things, like, especially in Mufasa. I mean, Mufasa and the Lion King.
That's another one. We get that a lot.
Dad, come on. You gotta get up. Dad, we gotta go home.
Help! Somebody! Anybody! Help!
We get that one a lot because fucking... The death scene with the wildebeests and Mufasa lying there and Simba trying to pick
lying
up his
there.
Paw.
Get up, Daddy!
How dare you make a pun at this time?
I'm 48 fucking years old, and thinking about that, I still get misty. It's just not right.
My wife just sent me a text message as we're talking, so I said, no, I can't talk right now, we're recording. And then I sent her a gif in the chat of Littlefoot and his mom, and I imagine that's going to make her very sad. I wasn't trying to make her sad. I was trying to be cheeky, but I'm kind of...
Well, don't listen to this episode.
But yeah.
But man, okay.
She sent back a gif of the pug with the Triggered logo under it. It's hilarious. I've triggered my wife. But yeah, Mufasa laying there dying, Simba trying to pick his paw up with him and just try to revive him, and then Scar coming around and just putting all of that directly on him, making him
just
believe
merciless.
He's responsible for his father's death.
Simba, what have you done? No one ever means for these things to happen. But the king is dead. And if it weren't for you, he'd still be alive. Run away, Simba. Run. Run away and never return.
Horrifyingly merciless. And
well, weren't you the one singing "I Can't Wait to Be King" just moments ago?
Yeah, I mean, you get this... Not only do you get your dad dying, you get the guilt of having to think it's all your fault. That really paints Scar as one of the nastiest villains in the Disney lexicon, I think.
Just the fucking psychotic gaslighting of all of that, to murder mm-hmm. the dude and then make the kid feel like it's his fault. He's, yeah, one of the evilest villains in all of Disney history, and that's a lot of competition for that title.
Although it is kind of telling that he just couldn't wait to be king, and now look what happened.
I had a couple from when I was a kid.
Hit me.
And I mentioned this one when we brought this up. I absolutely love Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka, but holy shit, that boat scene.
There's no earthly way of knowing
he's singing.
Which direction we are going. There's no knowing where we're rowing, or which way the river's flowing. Is it raining? Is it snowing? Is a hurricane a-blowing? Not a speck of light is showing, so the danger must be growing. Are the fires of hell a-glowing? Is the grisly reaper mowing? Yes! The danger must be growing, for the rowers keep on rowing, and they're certainly not showing any signs that they are slowing!
That boat scene. And there's no earthly way of knowing which direction we are going, but the rowers keep on rowing. I mean, he's this, from the moment he's introduced, he paints himself as this weird, eccentric, shut-in candy man. And that's really just the essence of his character. He's wonderful at that. Gene Wilder was a masterful actor, and it's one of my favorite films of all time. But that boat scene, I mean, it happens pretty early. Augustus Gloop already gets sucked up into the chocolate pipe, but the other four kids are still on the boat. And Veruca Salt, "Daddy, I want a boat like this." And then they get on the boat, and it's just terrifying. It's Willy goes completely psychotic, and he starts disassociating and just going into like this Vogon poetry. And then in the background, there's horrifying. There's actually, I don't know if you remember this, there are a couple different versions of it, but in the original version of the movie, there's this sort of like green screen effect behind them of like horrifying things happening. There's a time-lapse video of a fox decomposing and being eaten by maggots. Yeah. There's a quick shot of a chicken being beheaded. This is a children's movie. And he's got this 1,000-yard stare rattling off weird poetry on this boat, and the lights are flashing and people are screaming and there's just horrifying imagery happening. And then he gets done and he's like, "Okay, we're here, off the boat." And I'm like, what the fuck just happened? And
they don't mention it again. I need a minute.
It's just a thing that happens, and they don't mention it again. The kids all get off the boat, and the only thing anybody has to say is Veruca, "Daddy, I changed my mind. I don't want a boat like this." And that's it. This is a horrifying thing.
Yeah, it's...
And then it's over.
Yeah. Well, that movie's got a lot of adult content moving. Or in it, yeah. I mean. You got the... In fact, that most of the main children characters ostensibly die. Now, they kind of write that off in the end that they didn't die. But, you know, you kind of aren't... You got to show, not tell. Because we don't see that.
Oh, no, the kids are fine. It gets hand-waved. In the book, it's a little bit more clear. But, oh no, they're fine. They just, Veruca fell down the pipe and we managed to deflate Violet. Mike got put back together. It's all fine. Don't worry about it.
Which was the most horrifying one for you, by the way? I don't know.
Because we had
Augustus not just in the chocolate river, but getting sucked up into the pipe towards the incinerator.
Oh no, that pipe doesn't go to the fudge room. It goes to the furnace room.
The furnace, yeah. We got Violet Beauregard being turned into a giant blueberry and ostensibly having to get juiced.
Violet, you're turning violet, Violet.
And then you got Veruca Salt ending up with, she goes down into the bad nut room, which I don't remember what happens in the bad nut room. I don't know what that ultimate fate would have been. I don't remember. Right. But then you got Mike TV shrunk to infinitesimal size, like Inch High Private Eye from the old Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Yep.
But I don't know. Which one do you think is more horrifying? I kind of think Mike TV is kind of the more horrifying one, because at least ostensibly the other ones died from their injuries. Maybe not Violet, but getting squished and juiced. Yeah.
But it's... I don't know, man. It's tough. I think Augustus, the first one, I think they open up with the first one because there's the implication. Mike actually comes out kind of fine. His mom picks him up and puts him in her purse. Violet, the theory is she can be juiced and, but Veruca kind of disappears without a trace. And it's made pretty clear that Augustus goes to the furnace room. So, I think it's Augustus. I think they open up with the most horrifying one.
I think you might be right. But yeah, Willy Wonka was a minefield of inappropriate and possibly things for kids. I mean, look what happens to Charlie and Grandpa Joe as they drink the fizzy lifting juice and they're just ascending towards that giant steel fan whirling above their heads. It's like...
That was also fucking horrifying.
Are they going to end up like, as a red mist like that guy from Indiana Jones? Who knows?
You know.
Then they'd really have to squeegee the walls in there.
It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal. You stole fizzy lifting drinks. You bumped into the ceiling, which now has to be washed and sterilized, so you get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Yeah, I've seen Willy Wonka a couple of times.
But, okay, so Willy Wonka definitely is up there. You said you had a couple. What's your next one?
Well, there was that one, and then I had a couple of really niche ones that I think probably... nobody would necessarily remember. And I sent you an example of this. There was, my folks had cable when I was a kid. We were one of the few houses to have cable. And they put on all kinds of kids' movies, ostensibly kids' movies, I guess. I keep using that word, but it's appropriate in this instance. And there was a 1977 Japanese version of Jack and the Beanstalk, which was weird as shit. And if you want to kind of, it's, I don't know if it's worth watching, but if you go to YouTube and look up Nostalgia Critic Jack and the Beanstalk, there's a 15-minute breakdown of some of the more horrifying parts. But what it eventually, what it involves is your standard Jack and the Beanstalk story where he, you know, trades the cow for the beans and, you know, the stalk grows up to the sky and there's a castle up there. Right. And there's a princess who's in a trance and engaged to be married to this giant, and Jack has to save her. But the wedding scene in this movie is just the creepiest shit. Like, it haunted me for years. Hecuba, who's the evil witch who is the mother of the prince, sets up this chapel scene where she's draping, because they don't really have any guests, these paper cutouts over the pews. And there's a paper cutout that is the officiant. And there's this creepy song that he sings, and the animation goes all wonky like it's an acid trip, and it's just, it fucked me up for years. And that was really strange. The other one, the Are You Happy song, is if you want to look up just one section of this movie, type in Jack and the Beanstalk, Are You Happy, into YouTube, and prepare to have your shit rock, because it's bizarre.
Are you happy? Will you both stay together till you're old and gray? Can you stand living with each other till that day? Well, then, can you?
The other one was a movie that was an Australian film called Dot and the Kangaroo, where this little red-haired girl, Dot, gets separated from her family in the outback, and she finds this kangaroo who is, I think, I haven't seen it in years, but the kangaroo who's lost her Joey in a fire or hunting or something, and so she kind of adopts Dot, and Dot cottons to this kangaroo as her sort of, surrogate mom until she can be reunited with her family. And so there's two things that happen in this movie. First and foremost, there's a small film within the film that's an animated section. The whole movie's kind of animated. It's weird. It's kind of like animation over a live-action background, but whatever. There's an animated section in the film, then it's a song called The Bunyip. And The Bunyip is an aboriginal cryptid, like a monster of aboriginal legend that apparently kills livestock and, you know, comes out after dark. And if you're out hunting, you want to make sure you watch out for it. It's a boogeyman, an aboriginal legend. But the movie uses Aboriginal-style art to make this sort of animated sequence about the bunyip, about how it rises out of the swamp, and you better get home early, and you don't go out hunting, or the bunyip's going to get you, and it emerges during the full moon, and it scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. And you better hide very soon, or the bunyip's going to get you. It's creepy. The music is on this really creepy minor key. We could probably put a clip of it in here. And it's just creepy as hell. And the animation's very, like, stilted. And it's this weird skeletal aboriginal cave art style. And it's just bizarre. And then at the end of the movie, the kangaroo brings Dot back to her family. And then drops Dot off. And Dot is safe. And then the kangaroo turns around and books it. Turns around and leaves. And Dot is left at the fence crying, sobbing bitter tears because she's bonded with this kangaroo, and the kangaroo just hops back onto the outback, and the entire end credits of the movie is Dot sobbing, "Oh, come back, kangaroo," while the animated kangaroo turns into a live kangaroo and just hops away and leaves her. And so then you sort of realize, well, she was separated from her family throughout the most of the movie, and then her surrogate mom just abandons her when she, you know, finds her family again. And it was heartbreaking. It was the end of the movie. It's just this child, who's this cherubic little child, who's portrayed to be maybe 5 or 6 years old, leaning on a fence, crying bitter tears as her friend the kangaroo hops away. And it still fucks me up to this day, and I haven't seen this thing since I was maybe the age of the character. Maybe
I could see you getting emotional just talking about it.
Oh, God, it was so sad. And it was on cable as a kid's movie. And so, obviously, now you have internet resources and IMDb and things like that where parents have resources. And I'm not blaming my parents for this at all. It was a kangaroo cartoon. They didn't have it. But they plunk your kids down. Oh, it's a cute cartoon about a kangaroo and a little girl. Watch this. And then it's got this scary as fuck bunyip music in it with this creepy art. And then she gets abandoned by her surrogate kangaroo mom at the end. And it's just heartbreaking. There's no happy ending to this movie.
Well, speaking of a movie with not a whole lot of happy ending in it, and this movie fucked me up as a kid, and a couple of my friends commented on this movie as well. We've talked about it on the podcast previously. Transformers, the animated film. Now, this movie came out in 1986, surrounding the Gen 1 continuity of Transformers, the original cartoon. Seasons 1 and 2, I think, is where it was leading into, but this movie, I mean, in the show, you get Autobots wrecked to the point where they had to be repaired, and Decepticons being destroyed to the point where they had to be repaired, but they always seem to have that bounce back. They never seem to be permanent. But in this movie,
I mean, they're robots. They can always be fixed.
And I read why. They wanted to release a new toy line, a new version of Transformers, a new generation. But to do that, they had too many in the pipeline already, so they had to get rid of some of the previous cast of characters to make way for the new one.
Why not just kill them off? They're only beloved characters kids have been living with for years.
I'm going to go down a list of the Transformer Autobots, your friends and allies who died just in this movie. Brawn, shot to death. Anyone who puts a pop-up ad that pops up over the middle of what the fuck you're reading should be shot in the face.
Fuck him.
Like Brawn. Now, Brawn got shot in the chest.
Megatron! Decepticons! Die, Autobots!
I am a fortune.
Died by Megatron's hand. To be replaced by Huffer. Okay?
Yeah.
Prowl, one of Optimus Prime's trusted lieutenants. Police officer. Took a couple of shots at Starscream before Constructicon Scavenger blasts him, penetrating his armor and causing him to die horrifically as his eyes glow and he belches smoke and then goes quiet and falls in a heap. Visceral. Deeply visceral. Ratchet. Beloved Autobot medic. Shot to death by... As he was looking over Ironhide's injuries. Just shot to death on the Ark. Ironhide also shot to death. Blasted in the face by Megatron.
Such heroic nonsense.
Yeah. Just caps him off.
Callous disregard.
Dies in the Battle of Autobot City. Wheeljack dies in the Battle of Autobot City. But then, of course, you can't mention the Transformers movie without mentioning the most traumatic death. I don't want to say all those other ones weren't traumatic. I don't want to say all those other deaths didn't matter or didn't count. But when you kill Optimus Prime in front of the kids who have grown to see him as this fatherly figure, the leader of the Autobots, they killed him. Not only did they and all the other deaths in this show didn't do quite what they did to Optimus Prime, because they show Optimus Prime's color fading from him. They show him turn to grayscale, basically, as the force of his life joins the Matrix.
Prime, you can't die!
Do not grieve. Soon, I shall be one with the Matrix.
And leaves him.
Yep.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That again, absolutely we talked about with Bambi. It fucking gives you this, all of a sudden, this lack of permanence, this mortality that you're not aware of.
Yeah.
Or maybe you are aware of it, but maybe you're not as aware of it. But all of a sudden, it's right there in your face. I mean, if Optimus Prime, one of the strongest Transformers ever to live, can die, what chance do you have, you squishy little human?
You kid who gets bullied on the playground and gets your lunch money stolen and gets a dodgeball to the face. You know, Optimus Prime, the big heroic leader of the Autobots. He's literally a semi-truck, which you see on the road if you're driving with your parents all the time. And he could be killed. He could just, you know, his life can wink out in a second.
Yeah. So I remember that one getting me really, really bad.
All right. Here's a couple of things. We're running a little long, so there's some quick shots. No. Some things we definitely need to mention. Yeah, would us run long? Because of tangents? Never. Secret of Nim. Mrs. Yes. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim was a kid's book, but it was kind of a young adult book, kind of in like the mold of like Harry Potter or Percy Jackson before they called them that. And they made a kid's animated movie out of it, and it was just terrifying. These were ultra-intelligent rats that escaped from a research lab and set up a society, and Nicodemus was creepy, and Mrs. Brisby, depending on the version you watch, her kid was sick, and it was just, Don Bluth and very sophisticated and incredibly creepy. The Child Catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is another one that I see frequently cited as being one of those things that just kids, you don't want to think about, I can get kidnapped, I could wind up in a cage. But this is a lighthearted kids movie, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, We Love You, and there's this horrifying, distorted, creepy, deformed dude with candy who lures children into a cage and drives them away. Very, very terrible. Let's see. What else? The Witches. The Angelica Houston,
you know,
The Witches, based on the Roald Dahl book.
Witches. It's terrifying.
Yeah, when they
now I'm talking the original Witches.
And masks.
I'm talking the original one. I've seen the both of them. But the original one, Angelica Houston just transforming into this horrifying beast. It's just, and she's trying to stomp out and squish these kids that they've turned to mice. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
When Pinocchio and all the boys go to Pleasure Island and Lampwick turns into a donkey.
Yeah, because in addition to the fact that they're at Pleasure Island smoking and drinking, which you would never be able to get away with in a Disney movie nowadays, and I don't want to sound like one of those guys, but you really wouldn't be able to get away with that these days. But, watching him turn into a donkey, a jackass, right there in front of him is horrifying, because it's like, this is the consequences for your action. Don't drink or smoke, or you're going to turn into a damn beast.
And be Which I guess maybe whatever keeps adult. Kids off of the booze and the alcohol and the cigarettes until they get old enough to make those decisions, fine. But, I mean, still kind of fucked me up. Dumbo, another dead Disney mom.
Another dead Disney mom.
Just fucking horrifying. You know, I mean, she's in a cage first and foremost, and then, you know, she is trying to cradle Dumbo through the bars with her trunk. And, you know, leaving aside these sort of, like, incredibly racist crows in that movie that, you know, don't hold up now, but, like, another dead Disney mom, another orphan, another orphaned child in the Disney universe.
That seems to be a trope.
Yeah, yeah, Disney has a problem with moms. When Charlie goes to hell and all dogs go to heaven.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
Just, you know, Darn everything's Bluth red again. And there's these...
Scarring our Darn
children. Bluth again, goddamn. And demon dinosaurs with wings and bones and just horrible. Large Marge in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Not only is it a ghost story, not only is it creepy to begin with, but the bug-eyed monster face that pops up on that screen for not long, but just long enough to haunt your fucking nightmares as a 10-year-old, that's one that definitely bears mentioning.
Yeah. Jesus, Large Marge. I forgot about Large Marge.
Be sure and tell him Large Marge sent ya!
The Dark Crystal.
Oh, that movie still fucks me up. I started watching the TV show. I couldn't get much into the TV show because, I don't know, maybe I'm still scarred as a child. But both The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, frequently shown together, mm-hmm. are sold as a double pack. Both of those movies, very disturbing content-wise for kids.
The Skeksis with their peeled vulture faces and then, you know... And the Rock Biter and the Nothing. And well, that was Never-Ending Story.
That was Never-Ending Story,
but
yeah.
They kind of all blur together after a little while. Yeah. So it's just creepy, creepy stuff that should not be in a kid's movie. Coraline, based on a Neil Gaiman book.
I have not watched Coraline, but I've heard enough creepypasta about it.
Yeah, Coraline, based on a Neil Gaiman book. It's I didn't see it, but it pops up a lot in these kind of discussions about the creepy mom with the button eyes, and you know it's another one that a lot of people it came along after I was kind of a grown up, but they didn't you know it's not one I've seen, but it gets cited a lot
You're
as being
a grown
super
up
super
now.
Creepy. Yeah, that's true. Really not.
I wanna be a Toys R Us kid.
Man, there's so many. Jesus Christ, there are some really hard moments in E.T.
Yeah.
Speaking of mortality.
Yeah.
You really get
that
to see.
That at least kind of, you know, had a kind of a tacked on happy ending, but, I mean,
What about the Army of the Dead in Black Cauldron? Do you remember that?
No. Yes,
horrifying.
I do.
Like, that horrible green slime coming off of them. And,
the creepy toys that came out from under Sid's bed in Toy Story.
Which we learn are not creepy. They're nice. But initially,
yeah, but
that
original
that
appearance,
moment, yeah, just, they're yeah. Well, you know, because the toys are alive, and you know these toys have been mm-hmm. tortured by Sid and body swapped by Sid and turned into these monstrosities by Sid. Jesus, I mean, what else
That'll
can you say
you
about that? I mean,
that will definitely mess you up.
And luckily, they turned out to be friendly and help our Woody and Buzz and all that. But I mean, it's still really, really disturbing to know how they got to the state that they're in. I mean, for fuck's sake, he's about to blow Buzz up with a rocket. You gonna blow him
yeah,
up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and another mom Disney death in Fox and the Hound. That's another one that definitely messed me up as a kid.
Well, and abandonment. He gets abandoned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Todd does, and that's terrifying. What else do we got? The drunk Dumbo scene in. When Dumbo gets drunk, the horrifying Pink Elephants on Parade song.
Look out, look out, Pink Elephants on Parade, here they come, hippity hoppity, they're here, and there are Pink Elephants everywhere.
That was pretty fucked
yeah.
up.
Yeah. I mean, Bruce getting forced to eat the entire cake in Matilda.
I never really sat through the entirety of Matilda, I really like the actor involved with that. I like Danny DeVito, obviously.
Mara Wilson.
Yeah. She's cool now.
Yeah.
But Danny DeVito's always fun. I love Danny DeVito, but fuck, just what I've seen in that movie, yeah, it's a little creepy. But I mean, we could literally go on for days with this. There's just so much.
Oh, gosh. And just one or two quick little ones here that, again, they're not animated films, but they are kids' films. Bridge to Terabithia has been adapted a couple of different times.
Jesus.
And also...
Waterworks. I know where you're going with the next one.
To this day, I want to find out whose idea it was to take beloved, goofy kids actor Macaulay Culkin from Home Alone and kill him in My Girl because of bee stings. That, I mean, he's laying in a coffin. He's got welts on his face. Every kid gets stung by a bee at some point. So that's an incredibly realistic, visceral, this could actually happen to you thing. And
he can't
see
without his glasses.
Want to go tree climbing, Thomas J? His face hurts. And where is his glasses? He can't see without his glasses. Put his glasses on. Put on his glasses. He was going to be an acrobat.
He's gone, sweetheart. He's gone.
Where are his glasses?
Oh, Jesus. Christ, I'm a crumpet. Yeah, it's... Ooh! Jesus Christ. Okay, so, yeah. These are all things that were in kids' movies. Movies aimed at kids, from Dead Dogs to Death to Body Horror to Going to Hell. A lot of these come out in different times. We'll just say that. And like you said a minute ago, you couldn't get away with this shit now, but good Lord, did they try and pull the wool over kids' eyes years ago and slip this sneaky, scary shit into these movies and TV shows. And man, some of this stuff still kind of makes me a little queasy and shaky in my boots.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to have seen other shit, but I mean, they did sneak a lot of this stuff. I don't think they were sneaking in it. I think they were trying to put in these adult messages into these movies, whether it's not to bring the kids up to, I don't know, bring them out of their innocence or whatever you have it, but it was definitely intentional. I don't know if they were cackling with glee behind the scenes as they did it, going, oh, this is going to really fuck them up. But, oh man, wait till Mufasa dies. There's not going to be a dry eye in the house. You know, I mean.
These kids are going to have to go into therapy for years after this shit.
Brilliant. But yeah,
let us know. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think. Tell us what movie just truly brought those adult themes that your poor little childlike mind couldn't process correctly at the time.
Ready to deal with it.
Just let us know. We of course want this to be a two-way conduit of conversation. You can find us, like we said, on all your podcasting platforms, but you can hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/afuelyourfandom. You can send us an email at fuelyourfandom@gmail.com.
FYFTalentBooking@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram at @FuelYourFandom. You can dig us up on what's left of Twitter at @Fuel_Your, and you can find us anywhere fine podcasts are sold, bought, traded, stolen, bartered, what have you. And as always, the latest and greatest episodes go up really early Friday morning, thanks to my boy Saint over here at FuelYourFandom.Buzzsprout.com.
Yes, sir. I've actually been playing around with the idea of uploading at midnight, but then I realized I wouldn't be able to share it until 8 in the morning anyway, because I'm not getting up at midnight to throw it on Facebook. Nobody's around on Facebook. Not nobody, but less people are around on Facebook. Yeah, I am too.
Yeah.
It comes with getting off of work at 10 o'clock at night, and you can't just go right to sleep. But
honest to God,
it's hard sometimes. But
that's what she said!
I don't know. Well, however you get us into your ear pipes, we're happy to be there. We love it. It's nice and warm. But let us know. Also, again, we're going to post pictures of our geekospheres, our nerd caverns, for y'all to check out. And we would love to see your environments as well. Show us what fuels your fandom as well.
Show me what you got. I want to see what you got.
We're going to post that on the Facebook. We're going to post those on the Instagram. And we probably post them to Twitter. I don't usually do a whole lot with Twitter or Instagram too much, so we need to get back in the habit of doing that. But send us what you got, and we will send you a shout-out as well. We'll talk about them. But from me and Jim to you, we want to thank you for listening to another episode of the Fuel Your Fandom Podcast. And please do remember that everything is fandom, and fandom is everything. Take care. We'll be right back.
his glasses on.
You don't know.
Put on his glasses.